From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. First of all, congrats to the Golden State Warriors, NBA champs, defeating a tough Cleveland team. Later tonight, by the way, the dangerous game called Charlie Charlie. We'll talk about that and why it seems to be so demonic. Here is what's happening. Oh boy, Tropical Storm Bill barreling down into Texas, hitting the coast there, packing howling winds and promising to dump as much as 12 inches of rain on a region still recovering from a recent flood. The storm sent waves crashing against the seawall on the barrier island of Galveston before moving along the coast. Sustained winds of 60 miles an hour, heavy rain could bring major flooding to a state experiencing one of the wettest springs on record. Austin was expected to get as much as 12 inches of rain. Alex Jones is down that way. And other parts of Texas and Oklahoma, anywhere from 4 to 8 inches of rain. Asteroid Icarus, the kilometer-long space rock named after the Greek mythological character that flew way too close to the sun, will just skimmed past planet Earth tonight, making a very rare distant pass of just 5 million miles. U.S. government debt held by the public is expected to rise to 107% of the economy in 2040 from just 74% this year, according to the Congressional Budget Office, citing an aging population, rising health care costs for pushing up the debt. Let's check in with Solari's Catherine Austin Fitz. Will we ever get out of debt, Catherine?
Well, George, there are many different ways of getting out of debt. We can get out of debt. The question is, do we want to get out of debt?
Good question. I don't think we do.
Well, I used to have a pastor and say, if we can face it, God can fix it. But there's a lot of facing that has to go on. I will tell you, George, if you look around the world, we now have 40 countries with debt more than 100% of GDP. But if you look at those countries, you need to divide them between the countries that can print the money that they've issued the debt in. Because remember, we can just print, we can pay off the debt because we can just print, you know, more dollars to do it. If you think about the countries that are borrowing in a currency they don't control, very different situation.
Catherine, as we look, here we are in June going into July in just a few weeks. As we push our way into the latter part now of 2015, how are things seeming to you?
Very sluggish. The economy, George, is very, very sluggish. And, you know, the sort of recovery has really never happened. And I will tell you, I think the number one problem in our economy is a breakdown in trust.
I think you're right. So what's new at Solari.com?
Well, I just got back from Australia, and I want to throw some statistics at you.
Sure.
In 1990, the per capita GDP in Australia was $18,000. In the U.S., it was $23,000. In the U.S. in 2013, it was $53,000. Guess how much it was in Australia?
Oh, I bet it's higher, huh?
$67,000.
Uh-huh. They're doing well.
They're doing well down under.
You've got it, anyway, Catherine.
It was very exciting to be an economy that was really rocking and rolling. So we can do it. We just have to turn it around here.
Exactly right. We're going to see what's going to happen, too, as we get into 2016 and the next presidential election, because a lot of these candidates are saying they can save the economy. A balcony collapsed at an apartment building in Berkeley, California, killing 5 Irish students, 1 American student, leaving 7 others injured there. The FBI and Justice Department prosecutors are investigating whether front office officials for the St. Louis Cardinals, one of the most successful teams in baseball over the past 2 decades, hacked into the internal networks of a rival team to steal closely guarded information about player personnel. Investigators have uncovered evidence that Cardinal officials broke into a network of the Houston Astros and housed special databases that the team had built. Internal discussions about trades, proprietary statistics, scouting reports were compromised. A friend of mine sent me a text message tonight and said, why in the heck would the Cardinals tap into the Houston Astros? Tap into a team that's winning. Well, he might be right there. One of the young victims of a pair of brutal shark attacks in North Carolina spoke out from his hospital bed, calmly describing how he just didn't see the shark until it chomped down on his arm and got that off. The 16-year-old lost part of his arm in the attack off the coast of Oak Island, North Carolina. He said that he won't let this trauma incident get him down. He's going to have a normal life, he said. Good for him. And a 12-year-old girl who also lost an arm in a similar attack in the area is expected to be able to keep one of her legs, which was also injured in the attack. Sad story there. Steve Alton, of course, has written the Meg series on sharks, which is going to be turned into a movie, by the way. Steve, I want to ask you, because you do know about sharks, what causes them to attack this way?
Well, first, George, there's a difference between biting and attack. A bite, a shark will usually let go right away. An attack, which both of these incidents were, this was definitely an attack. A shark was not going to let go. And there's a number of different causes. This was probably a bull shark because it happened in shallow water. And bull sharks have more testosterone than them than any other animal on the planet. Bull sharks can also live in fresh water as well as salt water, so they're equally dangerous. But it could be a number of things. There's been reports that fishermen in the area were luring fish in off a pier by throwing chum in the water, so that could have attracted the shark. And large schools of fish were seen off the coast in the area, which also draws the sharks in. The sharks follow the fish right up toward shore, and then movement stimulates them to attack. There was also, I'm also understand that the attacks occurred 2 days before a new moon. New moon brings sharks close to shore because of the higher tide.
Right. I would suspect, Stephen, this might have been the same shark that bit these two youngsters. What do you think?
I agree with you 100%.
What's new on this Meg movie I hear so much about?
Well, it was just an announcement tonight, sort of an unofficial announcement that Eli Roth is going to be the director.
Oh, good for you.
And Warner Brothers is doing the movie. So we're probably looking at a 2017 release, which is kind of exciting. And we'll see what happens.
Well, you deserve it, my friend. Keep in touch. Steve Alton talking about shark attacks. Trans fat, unsafe to eat, and must be banned from the food supply within 3 years, according to U.S. regulators. Are they finally doing something for our benefit? The U.S. Food and Drug Administration said partially hydrogenated oils, the main source of trans fats, are not generally recognized as being safe. It said a ban would save lives by preventing fatal heart attacks. Well, that's something we need to get rid of. Roughly half of the deaths from 12 smoking-related cancers may be linked directly to cigarette use, according to a U.S. study. And while the largest proportion of deaths associated with smoking were for cancers of the lung, trachea, and larynx, about half of the fatalities from tumors of the oral cavity, esophagus, and bladder also tied to cigarettes. Let's check into our expert, MyHeartBook.com's Christian Wild. Christian, we always knew cigarettes were bad, but here we go again, another study that proves it.
Yeah, haven't we learned?
Yeah.
My goodness, this is a study that's a real dose of reality, George, particularly when the information comes from the American Cancer Society. So you would think we would have gotten this anti-smoking message a long time ago. It's not only expensive in terms of our health care, but the tons of human suffering that are associated with it, and the financial cost to families who are paying for cigarettes when their money could be better spent. You know, I wonder, George, how many non-smokers listening tonight are aware of the cost of a pack of cigarettes today. I just posted the cost for all 50 states on the website. And here's a shocker, George.
Here we go.
New York leads the nation, where a pack of cigarettes costs $12.85 a pack.
That's because of the tax that's tied into that, right?
I think the mayor may have done that. $12.85 a pack in over 20 years, that cost would amount to $94,000 at one pack a day. And if two smoke in the same family, which is not unusual, man and wife, that's $188,000. So, George, what have we been thinking? Or what have we been smoking?
Good point. Christian Wild's website, myheartbook.com. He's got all kinds of great information there. in a moment, we are going to talk about some incredible stories with Timothy Green Beckley. Shirley MacLaine meets the Pleiadians. How about that for starters? He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, and our dear friend Timothy Green Beckley is back. Okay, he's the author, publisher, he's a producer, he's a paranormal investigator. He has traveled all over the planet in search of the unexplained. He has told about his encounter with a man in black on UFO hunters and recently tried to convince William Shatner that a small figure, said by some to be an alien, was in actuality a member of the mythical Jinn family that they talk about so much in the Middle East. We're going to talk about Tim's latest works, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Timothy, welcome back.
Well, thank you, George. Good to be back on tonight and be here with your our large audience and to discuss a subject that fascinates both of us, I guess, and a lot of people, UFOs and celebrities.
Oh, my gosh, great stuff. Yeah. And by the way, in about a half hour, we're going to call Larry Warren, who was involved in the Rendlesham case, to bring him in on this story, too. But
yes, he's our mystery guest for
that's right
for this evening. Yeah, you know, of course, he's living over in Liverpool now. He's married. He has a son. I did visit with him a couple of months ago. He was here in New York. And he had the opportunity, you know, because of his experience at Rendlesham, to meet a lot of celebrities who are anxious to kind of pick his brain, because certainly that case is one of the more high-profile ones and certainly of more substance than probably 98% of the other sightings and encounters. So he's going to come on, and he's going to tell us his experience with none other than Jackie Gleason.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is going to be a first-hand account.
And that's a great story. And Tim, tell me, how difficult was it for you tracking down these celebrities to talk about their UFO cases?
Well, you know, it's not like I did this over a period of, 6 months or something. I probably started, I think in 1965, I was a stringer for the Inquirer, the Globe, and a lot of the tabloid newspapers. You know, in those days, the paparazzi, there really weren't any, and journalists were welcome in most cases in the homes and to interview, you know, well-known personalities. They were looking for the publicity just as much as we were looking to write a very good story. Of course, all things have changed today, and I don't think I could do the job that's necessary today to chase somebody down the street. That wasn't my style. You know, they would either call us and let us know they were in town, you know, their agent or publicist, or we would have a list of celebrities where they normally stayed, and we knew where they, you know, when they were coming into town, and it would be in Variety or Billboard or something like that, and they welcomed talking to us. All right, now, so I was writing for the Inquirer, and we were looking, you know, for like stories that we could sell. You had to send in a lead paragraph,
mm-hmm.
and if they went for it, then you had the assignment, and you could go and talk to the celebrity, knowing that, you know, whatever they said would get in print. So the first three outlines that we submitted, they bought all three ideas, and so we were kind of on our way. And we met some very interesting people, you know, like we'll get into it later on. But Muhammad Ali became a friend for a while. We went to his training camp up in Pennsylvania. We brought Uri Geller with us, and we went to his home when he was living in Cherry Hill. And let me tell you what a home that was. I don't believe I've ever seen as many classic cars parked in one circular driveway. Well, I don't think anybody has ever seen that. You know, it was like a museum. Driving in there, and of course he had his entourage of very unusual people as well. So, I had always been actually in, you know, the publishing business. I started out when I was 14. I bought a little mimeograph machine with the money that I had saved up and started putting out the Interplanetary News Service.
I love
report.
It. A little entrepreneur you were, huh?
I was. And I guess I still, the years have gone by, George. But I guess in a sense it's become harder to be a publisher. I mean, there are very few left these days, certainly as far as magazines and all go. And you know, book publishing, we now have over 200 titles up on Amazon, and we still do a couple, you know, new books every month. I've learned from experience how to do them relatively, you know, inexpensively. You can't pay big advances, you know, anymore.
Now, those days are gone.
Yeah, we do have an in-house team of people. Tim Schwartz has been on the show, and Sean Castile and Bill Kern and Nick Redford writes for us from time to time, and Scott Corrales. And I guess I gathered all these writers and people that helped me when I was doing the various magazines. I did a magazine, a newsstand magazine called UFO Universe, that lasted for 11 years until the bottom of the publishing business just totally collapsed. The publisher that I was doing it for had something like 40 magazines. And he called me up one day and said, we're suspending publication.
Wow.
And I said, oh, I thought the magazine was at least breaking even. He said, yeah, well, UFO Universe is breaking even, but some of the other titles are losing thousands of dollars a day.
So, Tim, as you got into this, why'd you key in on celebrities and their UFO cases? Was it because their notoriety would give you more exposure?
Well, no, because actually, in the case of the tabloid, they very seldom used the name of the writer. They would hack. If I sent them in a 5-page article, let's say to the Inquirer, they would hack it down to maybe 6 or 7 paragraphs and put the name of the fellow who was the local editor down in Florida who was assigned to the story. They would put their name on it, so our name didn't appear all that often. But, you know, I did later on, of course, include most of the material in books. I did a column called Saucers and Celebrities that ran for a number of years in a magazine called the Saga's UFO Report. So we got a lot of mileage out of the story. And also, frankly, you know, like some of the celebrities, what are you going to ask? I mean, you know, rags to riches was very big at one point. They wanted to know how the celebrities had gone from, you know, being poor to being, you know, like very popular. But some were going in the opposite direction that I interviewed, actually.
That happens. That happens.
That happens. You know, it's like some of my friends, I have a lot of friends who are rock musicians, you know, and they've played for huge, you know, auditoriums and stadiums of 10,000 people or more.
Yeah.
And then when their careers start to fade, you know, it's in your blood, George, you know, like whether you're a writer or a radio talk show host, you do what you do. That's what you were made to do. And so they continue on. And the same thing here. I've been doing this for over 50 years, and we'll continue to do it until I've run out of ideas, and I have no shortness of ideas. I mean, ideas we have plenty of.
Tim, what keeps pushing you, though, with the UFO end of it? Because you've had some incredible stories and incredible books about UFOs.
Yes, well, you know, I've had three experiences in my career or in my life. The first at the age of 10, you know, I saw these two circular objects outside the home that I was living with my parents in New Jersey. And then I had a sighting in England. I was invited over by my friend, the Earl of Clancarty, the Brinsley Laporte Trench. And he had an unofficial group at the in the House of Parliament. Actually, he was like the first disclosure guy, long before anybody else, you know, came along. So in the early 1980s, he invited me to come over and make a presentation to this unofficial group, which was made up of about maybe 100 members of Parliament in the House of Lords. And while I was there, I went to Stonehenge, of course. I went to Loch Ness, and I took a side trip to the town of Warminster. Now, at one point, Warminster was the hottest UFO flap area. I mean, people were going out there every night on the outskirts of town, Star Hill and Cradle Hill, and looking up into the sky and seeing some incredible objects. In fact, Mick Taylor, who was a guitarist for the Rolling Stones, he went up there one time with my friend Arthur Shuttlewood, who has since deceased, and the lights from the UFO were so brilliant that they could actually see the sheep grazing in the field.
You were almost guaranteed, Tim, to see a UFO out in that area. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk more with you about that and then your latest work. Our friend, by the way, Shirley MacLaine meets the Pleiadians. That'll be next, too, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, this is the moment where I want to remind you about some programming notes. First of all, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Please download our free apps. You'll find them in your respective stores, the Google Play Store or your iPhone store. Take that. Okay, welcome back to Coast with Timothy Green Beckley. Gosh, there's so much I want to talk with you about, Tim, but let's get into Shirley MacLaine, one of our dear friends. She's been on our program several times. She almost choked to death the last time she was on. She just sent us an email saying, oh, my God, I won't choke next time. I think the world of her. You have selected her as well. Tell us about this.
Well, you know, I should point out that Shirley has not endorsed the book. She hasn't actually even seen it yet. But I picked her as being a representative of probably the person that is the most involved in the subject as far as the celebrities go. In fact, her interest in UFOs dates back to 1952. She was living outside of Washington, D.C. at the time, in Virginia, and this was the summer that UFOs appeared on several occasions over the District of Columbia, including right over the White House on one occasion. And Shirley was read the article in the, you know, in the newspaper, in the Washington Post, and wrote up what you know, what it had said and put it in her diary. And she noted that you know, the military, the Air Force, had sent up several jets to try to intercept the objects, but every time they closed in on them, the objects would speed away. And of course, the UFOs, I think there were 12 or 13 of them at one point, were picked up on radar. And every time the military planes would be sent up to, you know, scurry across the sky to try to close in and see what these objects were, the objects would take off in various directions. So this is still one of the best UFO sightings, even though I think the official government explanation, George, was that they were temperature inversions.
Inversions, yeah.
Yes.
Typical. Typical.
Yes, typical. But especially in this in this case, I mean, the pilots saw them. They were seen from the ground. In fact, most people don't realize this, but a chunk of one of the objects apparently was shot at. The UFO was shot at, and a chunk of the object landed in a fellow's backyard in the in Virginia, and he actually worked for the military. He was in the CIA later on in the Navy. And well, his name was Captain Alvin Moore, and he put the piece of wreckage or debris that had been shot off in his safe in his office, and supposedly nobody outside of him knew the combination. Well, when he went to get the chunk of metal to show it to people or to have it analyzed, it was gone. And well, he's not alive today to talk about it, but he had no explanation as to how anybody could have gotten into that safe to retrieve the object. And, you know, people would say, oh, you know, it was the government, they could get in and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it could have just as well been the beings or the entities on board the craft not wanting any physical, you know, evidence left behind. So Shirley, you know, then on, started you know, reading up on the subject, and I know she was going through a bookstore in Paris, and a book called "A Dweller on Two Planets" literally fell into her hands. Now, this book was channeled, I think in about 1885 or so, by a young gentleman who was working for his father. He would ride on horseback every day and check the fence posts to make sure that they were, you know, sturdy and, sure, and hadn't fallen over so that the cattle didn't get off the property. And every day he would fall into this light trance and started channeling this Tibetan. I believe it was a being from Atlantis, you know, and he did a book which was published many years later, this Dweller on Two Planets, And some of the drawings in the book are quite remarkable in that they show, you know, craft, some of them going into the water, some of them just darting across the sky, cigar-shaped objects and dish-shaped objects, and they look uncanny, just like photographs that were taken, you know, 50 years later. And these were drawings, and they're just such a remarkable, you know, similarity. So Shirley, I guess, started her own, you know, vision quest. She traveled around to Peru. She had a number of experiences where she saw objects herself. There was one in New Mexico that she said was a giant craft, a giant mothership of some sort. And in fact, two people who were there with her, who were in the hot tub at the point, saw the object directly overhead. So she's had a very, very deep background and association with the subject. I would, you know, consider her kind of like part of the New Age movement.
Sure.
Again, she was on, you know, Larry King a couple of years ago when he was discussing the UFO subject, and she sat there, and, you know, I was kind of cringing and thinking she might come out with some stuff that he would consider pretty wild or the audience would not be, you know, prepared for it. And no, she just talked about sightings that the military person, mm-hmm. Personnel had.
She was very pragmatic, Tim.
Yes, indeed, and that's the way it should be, you know. But she's had a lot of incredible experiences. In fact, of course, she went to Peru and she went to meet Billy Meyer and. Switzerland,
sure. And Tim, we'll come back to this, but we've got Larry Warren on the line now. Larry, of course, cool. is credited as the person who broke the story of the Rendlesham Forest incident back in the 80s, the incredible story where so many military, both British and American eyewitnesses to this incredible object that was back there in the forest. And Larry, of course, had another episode because he had a dealing with the late comedian Jackie Gleason. Let's go to the United Kingdom live. Larry, welcome to the program, and you're on with Tim Beckley with us.
Hey, Larry.
It's nice to be on with both of you guys, and thanks for having me on.
My pleasure.
It's great to have the opportunity. I listen to you, and it's nice to be on your program, and thanks for giving me credit for that, because it took 35 years to get it.
Well, you deserve it. Now, way back, it's been told that then-President Richard Nixon took Jackie Gleason, who was obsessed with extraterrestrial life, took him to Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, and apparently showed him some extraterrestrials. Larry, fill in the story for us. What do we know about this?
I'm happy to do that, because Tim, I've known for since the beginning when I opened my mouth on what was known as the Bentwaters incident. At some point in the early 80s or mid 80s, Tim was, as this was starting to break, as you know, the late Larry Fawcett and Barry Greenwood did a book called Clear Intent. In fact, it was the first book that, and this connects to Jackie, how this happened. When that came out, and Prentice Hall, which was a university press, really, put out their book, and it dealt with FOIA documents, which was a very unusual thing in 1983, to have all these things. FOIA was new then, so Air Force documentation on UFO incidents was kind of a big deal. So Larry Fawcett and Barry Greenwood, Larry, an active police officer at that time, serving in Coventry, Connecticut, there was a lot of media hype on this, and so he did. We had gotten the Halt memorandum out, from my information, the famous Colonel Halt's memo, and they were able to add that into the book. I didn't want my name used. That's where the Art Wallace thing came. I never used that name. They just barely came up with it until other people came forward. We ended up doing the Merv Griffin show, and I think you'd have to be over a certain age to remember Merv. He was a legend like the late Joe Franklin in New York, where Tim and I are from, that area. But we did that, and I was able to go out and do this thing in L.A. with on Merv. And Barry was not a guy that liked any kind of – he worked for the government, the post office at the time, did not want to do this. So we did the thing, and long story short, I think Zsa Zsa Gabor was on this show, and Merv with the classic ooh kind of thing, and
yeah.
sang songs, and it was great. But Jackie Gleason was doing a commercial of some sort in this facility where they shot Merv Griffin's show. And so Larry met him during this period. Back in the States, it was during the West, it all connects to the Westchester County UFO overflights, which were in the New York Times. I think I met you, Tim, at that point in 1980.
That's right. You were telling people about your experience on the high school steps there in Brewster at the town meeting that Dr.
Yeah.
Hynek was there, and Jacques Vallée and Peter Gersten and so forth.
And that's where I met my co-author, Peter Robbins, which I wouldn't re-meet him for another 4 years. But during that period, and I don't know if this was before or after that, because it's 1,000 years ago, but Larry invited me to near Briarcliff Manor, which is Westchester County, New York, and we went down, and he wanted to meet me. You know, it was like the cherry on the cake back then. And Jackie Gleason wanted to, and he not his house in Florida that you hear about that was like a circular thing. He had a normal kind of home, you know, a nice one, but a mm-hmm. normal one. And I spent a day with the guy, with Larry and some other people, and he was very, it was like hanging out with my father, to be honest with you, all day. And growing up with the Honeymooners, which I think was off the year before I was born, and I'm in my mid-50s now, it was an amazing time. But as he loved Clear Intent, he was fascinated with the documents, he had a lot of UFO books. I kind of knew his nephew, who was an up-and-coming actor at that time. I don't know what he's up to nowadays. And he did tell me, indeed, and I was not, I don't think this thing with his first or ex-wife or whatever that was, I never met a wife or what brand, where this was all alleged in the tabloids at
That's
that
right.
time or later on. I wasn't aware of that, and I think that came after when this happened with us. But we were sitting there, he had a sunken kind of room with the pool table, the bar, the whole this and that. And he liked Rob Roy's, and it was truly like a day with Dad. But he was fascinated, told me about the how Studio 54 in New York, the Disco Palace, was where they filmed the Jackie Gleason show. I didn't know that. That was a fun thing to find out. And he told me, no word of a lie, he told me that, and Tim was the first guy, and Peter, I think I told about this, and Larry mentioned it a few times, but he told me that he would play golf with Richard Nixon a lot, and he called him Crafty Richard, which brought that right back to my father. With that era, that's how they called Dick Nixon.
Yeah.
But they were close friends, and they were golfing friends. And so Jackie has a house in Florida, had a house in Florida, and Homestead Air Force Base, which was eventually wiped out by a hurricane in the early 90s, was a massive facility, and he wasn't too far from there. But Richard Nixon, the story, now people say maybe he was kidding with you and all this. I don't know. I was in my early 20s. I believed him, and I think he was telling it straight. He said, kid, listen, he goes, Nixon got away from his Secret Service in a car, whatever kind of car. I'm sure he wasn't driving a presidential limousine, but in a car, broke away from them, which they would often do. Both of them would go cruising around.
Mm-hmm.
Got him at his house, and it seems unusual. Maybe he could do it because that was a summer retreat for Nixon also down in Florida. And he picked him up. He said, I've got to show you this thing. You've got to come with me for this thing. Now it seems, how could he do this with classifications and security? They drove on to Homestead Air Force Base. The air police at the time at the gate kind of just stopped them, and then, you know, went three shades of whatever color. Because there they go. Secret Service caught up with them. They had, it wasn't like this was a facility. They had a wreck or something had crashed down in Florida at that time. And they had the wreckage, and they had apparently non-human beings in temporary, what he described as, you know, when the stories we told, it sounds very comical and all, but like Coca-Cola, the old freezers, it was very temporary. They had just to keep these things on ice. And he was shown a body or bodies of a non-human being. He didn't see wreckage of anything.
By Nixon.
His understanding something. Go ahead.
By Nixon, and it freaked him out, did it not?
Yeah. He Jackie Gleason and Nixon were actually very good friends. And I think a lot of guys from that era bonded over golf an awful lot. And it did freak him out. And again, I don't know. I didn't know him, but Jackie Gleason, I can say this, even though he's been gone many years, he died in 86, though I was on record with it before that. He was freaked out by it. And it wasn't like he was confiding in me alone. He had told a number of people, told Larry. I had no reason to disbelieve him, particularly why would I disbelieve anyone after what I went through. But it was very plausible, and that something had crashed and was a temporary triage for that wreckage. And he was brought on to allow to see this.
Do you have a description, Larry, a description of what they look like? Were they tall or short, or do they have almond eyes? Do they look like the cover?
Yeah, he just called them aliens, Tim. I mean, that's the classic, the gray kind of thing. I have hay fever beyond belief.
Oh, that's okay.
He described them, and I can look back and see the guy's face saying this to me, and Larry, is that it was non-human, and it was one or more in a cooler. I don't remember who said there was more, but it was the typical small being like children. You hear this description always, or the simplified way is it like children, and. Not a prop, not a hoax, nothing laid on him. The guy's in entertainment. He's a titan of entertainment, but I would say he was quite sincere. Now, as time went on, and that was just one part of the day, he didn't impart anything. He said, I was shown this. He had sightings in Florida. He was, I would say obsessed, but he was fascinated not only with the UFO subject, but from what I could see and what we talked about, all kind of paranormal things.
Well, Larry, he was kind of a regular guest on the Long John Nebel.
That's show. Right.
And he did have one of the largest private libraries on UFOs and the paranormal, which I believe is still housed at the University of Miami. In fact, he was the first celebrity who bought a UFO book from me. I think I still have his letter that he signed personally, and I understand the book is in the library. It was called UFOs Around the World. And so he was a collector of all this literature. Now, he was not a big believer in the contactees. He really was incensed by some of the stories that he heard, like by George Adamski and so forth. And I know he, on the Long John show, he really tried to to lay them out, so to speak, as far as their experiences go. And at one point, somebody actually invited him to take a trip in a flying saucer. There was a fellow by the name of George Marlowe out of St. Louis who was offering rides to celebrities. I think he offered a ride to Jack Parr and,
a little trip to Venus, Tim, huh?
Yeah, Steve Allen, and of course, Jackie Gleason was incensed when the trip never came off.
And I was told, Tim, that Jackie Gleason's wife or ex-wife, maybe, said that Jackie was never the same after he saw this extraterrestrial.
Well, would you be, George?
No. I couldn't wait to get back on the air to do that. Let me thank Larry for being on because we're coming up to the break. Larry, thanks so much, and we got to get you back on for a further show. Just great credentials. The person who broke the RAF Bentwaters Rendlesham Forest case, Tim, that's an amazing case. Tim, you stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment and talk more about celebrities and what they saw, and we'll take some phone calls as well right here on Coast to Coast AM. But that Jackie Gleason story was one incredible story.